How should Christians handle opposition and false accusations? Welcome again to The Good Word. My conversation partners this week are Troy Fitzgerald and Jennifer Ogden, and both serve as pastors at the Walla Walla University Church, and I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author. We're continuing a 13-week series on the Book of Matthew, and we are now in the closing scenes and the final hours of Jesus' life before he dies. And in preparation for his death, Jesus spends some time at the house of Simon, who was apparently a Pharisee and at one point was a leper. And while he's there, Jesus is interrupted during the meal by a display of ostentatiousness that maybe had not been seen in that culture ever. A woman comes in and breaks open a bottle of very expensive perfume, pours it on Jesus' head and on his feet, and begins to wipe his feet with her hair. The response of the people around is interesting. Simon, the Pharisee, is he all right with that? Judas. Well,
the disciples are indignant. You know, they get upset by it, indignant.
They're shocked.
Yeah.
And why on earth, why'd you waste such money that has been invested in this? What a ridiculous thing to do.
Judas, ever one to worry about the money, mm-hmm. says, shouldn't this have been money been given into my money purse and given to the poor?
Oh, please.
Yes.
Well, the irony, especially when we just put this little story against the backdrop of the whole, against the Book of Matthew, the showing Jesus with his kingly right to rule in his kingdom. This is one of Matthew's key themes. And then the idea that somebody would anoint extravagantly without expense the king, that would not be questioned in the court of a king. It would never be questioned. It wouldn't be considered a waste.
It would be the appropriate gesture to one to whom the people pay homage.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So how odd is it that only one person knows that she is in the presence of royalty? Yeah.
And what does Jesus respond? What does he say to the people?
It's too good. You get to read it.
Why are you troubling the woman? Like, don't give her a tough time. She's doing a good work for me. You have the poor with you always, but me you will not have always. In pouring this fragrant oil on my body, she did it for my burial.
Suggesting that this is a literary but also a life foreshadowing.
Yes.
Of what's to come.
Yeah.
Once again, Jesus saying, look, I'm going to go to death. And what she's doing is an act of pre-burial. Did Jesus get anointed? Mm-hmm. Was he ever embalmed after he died? Did the women who came to the tomb after Jesus' crucifixion, did they ever get to put the 70 pounds of anointing spices that Nicodemus carried that he purchased, did they ever get to put those on his body?
Nope.
We don't see any indication.
Think so. Yeah.
But this woman got to. And if we conflate the stories, we get an idea that maybe this is Mary Magdalene, you know, good friend of Jesus, out of whom he casts demons. Beautiful, beautiful act, preparing for Jesus' death. But we read
We can't go on because Jesus says that it's not the gospel unless you tell our story.
Unless you tell our story. Thank you. Yeah, right, so I appreciate that. We can't tell the rest of the story.
I've got the gospel truth. So I wanna hear it. I wanna see if you'll tell this woman's story. Yeah.
The gospel will not be preached without it being known what she's done. What an amazing testimony for her.
Yeah.
And to go through the moments of rebuke. And for her, in a way, she's being accused falsely of not being worthy of doing this. But in essence, there's nobody more valuable because to those who have been loved much and forgiven much, you know, they're able to love much in return, right? Mm-hmm. We see Judas going out then and making plans to betray Jesus, and Jesus has a final meal with his disciples in the upper room. Now, Matthew doesn't tell us anything about a foot washing, but we have to read the Gospel of John for that. But we do read here that Jesus spends time eating the Passover meal. And while they're eating, and there's this discussions about, again, who is the greatest? You know, several weeks ago, we talked about the children being brought in and that they were the greatest in the kingdom. You'd wonder if the disciples learned their lesson. Apparently not. Who is the greatest in the kingdom? It's the one who serves others. Jesus gives that example. Tell me about the Lord's Supper. Maybe can you give me a comparison between the way we practice today versus maybe what Jesus did there? Do we practice the Lord's Supper in the same way that Jesus and his disciples did? Are there differences? Are there reasons? If there are differences,
if there is one, I mean, one of the more immediate ones is that Jesus is eating a supper that is symbolic. It is a representation of something. It's historical. It goes back to the Passover. It goes back to the Exodus. They kept the supper. They ate the supper to remember a story, to remember a reality, to remember a truth about who they were. In the same way, we're doing that today. When we break the bread mm-hmm. and we take the cup, we're remembering the story. We're remembering our part of the mm-hmm. story. This mm-hmm. is not just the cross. This goes back to the Exodus, includes the cross, and goes on through eternity for us. But we're participating in it that way, too, symbolically.
Mm-hmm. And while we don't do it at all like they did, I mean, Jesus is in a small room with a small group of people passing cups and bread loaves, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
He's full
passing
cups.
It hand to hand. Yeah. And, you know, we tend to be in pews and have smaller cups and little wafers, and it's not quite the communal effort that it was then. And yet it still carries that same weight of the very personal Savior who did this for us individually, but also us corporately, yeah. and we get to participate in that together.
What would a Lord's Supper look like if it was celebrated around a meal table like Jesus and his disciples? Have you ever celebrated one like that?
Oh, yeah, many of those.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, here in our classes, when we study this, we'll put a banquet. I'll call the saints in the church, and they'll put a full meal out there. But then there's another part of it that's different. It's not the meal. It's the part where you take the cup and the bread, and it's different. It's you know, everybody eats meals, but this meal is different. This meal represents something. This represents what Christ did by spilling his blood and breaking his body for you. You take that as a choice to say, this is what happened. This is what would happen to me. This is what I trust in. I trust that Jesus paid the price for me. Mm. So those are all things that, you know, you can do symbolically and experientially in celebration.
Is this a meal that we can celebrate anytime, anywhere? Do I have to be in church to celebrate this remembrance?
I hope that we celebrate it more than just in a structure that says church building. You know, I hope we celebrate this with people and encourage people to celebrate this in remembrance of what Jesus has done.
I like that. It has to be in church, if by church you mean with two or more gathered.
Mm-hmm. Anywhere. I don't need to have one of you as a pastor serving
an
ordained elder giving me the bread and the
One of the beautiful things we do at our church is that we put the table out there in front. We did this deliberately, intentionally. Stick the tables out front, you know, and you come to the table and get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to have somebody. You don't have to have somebody hand it. You reach out and you grab it. Nobody's going to get in your way. Nobody's going to stop you. Nobody's going to ask any questions. You come freely to that table of grace and get it.
Yeah.
And the symbols, the wine or the juice, oinos in the Greek means wine sometimes was fermented. We even find in the New Testament church they were abusing the Lord's Supper, and some people were getting drunk, so they had fermented. We tend to use grape juice for those older and younger, especially the purity. of grape juice, fresh squeezed grape juice, and the bread, the unleavened bread. I've sometimes wondered if there is a way that I could have a cup of juice big enough to cover all my sins. You know, sometimes the way we practice it is less than I want.
A toothpaste cap. No, yeah. I'm on a campaign here. I want
a thimbleful.
I want 12 to 16 ounces. I want to feel the grace of God in my belly.
Yeah. And I agree.
I'm very kinesthetic that way. Sorry.
I agree. I want the symbol to be more than just a symbol. I want to have a sense of it. And yet, the symbol speaks to something greater.
Yes.
And that symbol
yes.
is that what Jesus has done by giving me his death, his body, his life, his death, his resurrection. After this meal, the disciples go out to the Mount of Olives again, to the Garden of Gethsemane. And there, Jesus begins to have a difficult evening, and perhaps it's already been coming on for a while, but he senses that his time with his Father is running short, and he takes three of his favorite disciples, Peter, James, and John, and takes them aside to pray, and he asks them to stay awake. What is so important about praying with and for other people who are in times of need? You two minister on a regular basis, and it is a privilege. I know in my years of pastoral ministry, it's a privilege to pray with people. But there are times when you're so burdened and you are so tired, and it's easy when you close your eyes to pray to just begin to drift off.
Yeah.
What do you do? Jen, what do you do when you're invited to pray with somebody going through a hard time? How do you respond to them?
I love to pray with people. There is a solidarity that comes from knowing that you are not in a situation by yourself, and knowing that someone else is asking for God's hand to move on your behalf. It's powerful, absolutely powerful to do. And I've got to be honest, as a pastor, I rarely have people come and pray with me. Mm-hmm. And boy, those times are precious and treasured. Because although I pray with a lot of people, it's so beautiful to have someone pray that blessing into my life.
To link arms and say, you have a difficult mission.
Yeah.
Let us join you.
We're in it. And there's power in that. There's power. There's solidarity. There's companionship. It's, you know, we're riding out into the fray together.
There's truth in it, too.
Yeah.
This is the truth. We're all kind of going at this together.
Yeah. We find Jesus' disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus is arrested. They abandon him, and that would be incredibly difficult. We follow Jesus' story through his courtyard scene, and false accusers are found to say of Jesus what is not true. They accuse Jesus of saying that he would tear down the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. According to John, we know that that was a metaphor for his body. We find that Jesus is accused of a number of things falsely. In the last few seconds that we have, how should I handle people's false accusations? What should I do? What did Jesus do?
Jesus stood silent.
He stood silent.
That's what I'm doing. No, he does exactly what Jesus knows to do. Jesus does not change in this moment. He is who he is. Everybody else falls apart.
But Jesus allows the accusations to be made and lets the truth come out later. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's best to be silent. Yeah. Thank you again, Troy and Jen. Our time is up. It's been nice to spend this quarter with you. We have one more week. Next week, we'll be looking at the crucifixion and the resurrection. Want to thank also our sound engineers, David Olson and Jared Miller, for their help. And for those of you listening in, thank you for the good word. I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.